You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately because it was growing more deadly every day.
That's former White House counsel John Dean testifying about a conversation he'd had with President Nixon in March 1973 about the Watergate scandal. Mr. Dean eventually became a critic of the Nixon administration, but still went to prison for his role in the break-in and cover-up. Now, four decades later, after he has spent years examining thousands of hours of tapes from the Nixon archives, many of them previously unheard, John Dean has written The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. It's a comprehensive catalog of the Nixon White House as it was consumed and eventually destroyed by Watergate. It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased to welcome John Dean back to our show today.
Thank you.
In the preface, you say that you are telling Richard Nixon's Watergate story. Why do you think no one else has told the story from Nixon's point of view?
Well, it's not really from his point of view. What I've done is I started with the premise of asking myself, how could somebody as intelligent as Nixon and as politically savvy make the mess of his presidency he made? And he did a good job. And I couldn't understand it. And I thought, maybe by looking at selective tapes and maybe transcribing a few more, I can get the answer to that. What happened in the long run is I had to transcribe everything to follow it day to day to day. And no one had done that. It reveals a lot of new information about what he did and why he did it. And it was something, had I known the size and dimensions of the task, I wouldn't have undertaken it.
But you also write that in listening to the tapes, you're often able to hear words and phrases others do not because of your familiarity with the players and the subject matter.
That's true.
In previous transcriptions, things sometimes were misheard.
Well, what happened is I was able to work with digital copies, which, as you know, in this digital era, we can do things with sound. It doesn't necessarily keep the voice accurate, but you can take words apart and you can play at different speeds. You can use different software. So I was able to tease out things that others weren't that tried it earlier with the analog version. So that helped a lot.
And you also knew the way these people talked.
In fact, the classic example is we had information that Mark Felt was a leak, a serious leak. And I got that information, brought it to the White House, and Haldeman reports it to Nixon. Well, when that happened, there was a recording of it, and the early transcripts of it all had Nixon saying at one point in the conversation to Haldeman, "You know what I would do with Felt?" And then he uses an expletive. I hear something very different, and as soon as everybody hears what I hear, they agree with me. And what he really says is, "You know what I would do with Felt, Bob? An ambassadorship." You can take your own imagination to what expletive he happened to use there. That's what he did with Helms. So it was a standard
procedure. But Felt did turn out to be Deep Throat.
He did turn. Well, Deep Throat was invented after all of that because we didn't know there was a character by that name. But we did know he was a serious leaker.
Of course, you were also on those tapes. Haven't your political views changed a lot since? Was it difficult to listen to the 30-something John Dean of four decades ago?
You know, I don't think my political views have changed very much. I've pretty much stayed where I have always been, and which puts me well to the left today. Really, you know, very few things I have changed my thought and my feelings about. But it didn't trouble me to listen to the story because I know how the story ends. You, for example, mentioned that, you know, I went to prison. Well, I really didn't go to prison. What happened, I was in the witness protection program for a year and a half. I had two marshals with me 24/7. And when it came time, I had pled guilty to conspiracy to obstruct justice.
A felony.
And when it came time, and the government wanted me incarcerated because it made me a better witness. I just went to a safe house, and I was driven to Washington every day. So while generically you could say he went to prison, I seldom contest that, it really wasn't. That.
Well, that's the way it's generally written. So I always believe the Internet.
I was going to say, the Internet has it, and as I was talking to somebody today, they said, you ought to correct the Internet. I said, well, I'm not a Wikipedia editor, so I'll have to live with it till somebody straightens it out.
But I was thinking about something else you just said, that you would be considered a liberal, at least then. Tom Wicker once wrote a book in which he said that Nixon was the last liberal president.
Well, he today,
because of so many of the things, affirmative action and the Environmental Protection Agency, et cetera, all sorts of things that now are under attack from the right are things that he signed the laws, or he followed the laws.
Well, you know what I think, Nixon, knowing him, particularly having studied him, spent as much time with him as I did, the number of years listening to all these conversations, I think he was something of a political opportunist. He probably would be a Tea Party activist today, and trying to lead that movement. So he would have been ahead of the curve on that. But yes, he was the last liberal president in some ways, you know, the creation of EPA. But these were things that he adopted that his staff, which was very moderate, actually, by and large, other than Pat Buchanan, to a degree, Haldeman was on the right.
But Ehrlichman, too.
Ehrlichman was very solid supporter of EPA. And that would be even that was fairly progressive at its time. So there was a mixed bag there. And of course, Moynihan was there, and Moynihan may be more libertarian in some regards, but certainly progressive on many, many issues, and certainly social issues. So he would embrace different members of his staff, and that gave you a president who today probably would not qualify ever to get a nomination for a Republican nomination.
Let's cut to the chase. Who ordered the break-in at the Watergate?
As best I can tell, it's certainly not Nixon. It certainly didn't come from Nixon.
How soon afterward did he find out?
Well, he finds out the time of the arrest, which is actually the second break-in. And what's ironic is that had the burglars not been arrested at the DNC on June 17th, which was not their true mission that night. They were really going to McGovern's headquarters. And as I point out in the book, you can trace from one of the recorded conversations between Haldeman and Nixon where he tells Haldeman to change or to get a plant. He uses PLANT, a plant, in the McGovern headquarters. Now, does that mean electronic surveillance? Probably not. Probably meant somebody, a secretary, a chauffeur, an intern, something like that. But given Gordon Liddy's disposition to stretch anything he was told to do, it would have been the beginning. And what Haldeman does is he tells his aide, Gordon Strawn, to have Liddy change his capacity from Muskie to McGovern. That's really where they're going the night of the 17th. They're going into McGovern's headquarters. Had they been arrested in McGovern's headquarters, you could trace Watergate right back to Richard Nixon. You can't do that with the break-in at the DNC.
Well, we know that Nixon had ordered break-ins at the Brookings Institution after the release of the Pentagon Papers.
I happen to be the person who stopped that, as it might be. I got wind of that, and I thought they were insane. And flew to California and got them to cancel that particular exercise.
Hadn't you helped recruit G. Gordon Liddy?
Well, you know, that's interesting. I did. I was asked to find a general counsel because my office was spending too much time working on legal issues for the reelection committee. And Haldeman instructed me to find somebody I thought was acceptable over there. I went to Bud Krogh and told Krogh that I wanted to have David Young, with whom he worked, come over, and I thought he'd be a good general counsel. He said, I've got somebody better for you, a fellow by the name of Gordon Liddy, who I hadn't met at the time at all. I know now from Krogh, who told me, he said, we were trying to ease Liddy off the staff. They did not tell me at the time that he had been involved in this Ellsberg break-in.
Did they see him as a loose cannon?
they did see him as a loose cannon, and they thought he would be safe there. But nobody told, neither Ehrlichman nor Krogh told anybody what they were sending over there, where they thought somehow he can't get in trouble over there. But the only thing Krogh did was call Magruder and say, this is somebody who needs a lot of supervision. And they immediately parted their way, and he got no supervision.
He should have been given an ambassadorship. John W. Dean is my guest. His latest book, how many books so far?
I think this is 11.
The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. Were you at any of the meetings that led up to the break-in?
Not to the break-in. What I was, when Liddy went over to the re-election committee, I was asked by Magruder to come to a meeting in Mitchell's office where Liddy presents his plan. And they're absurd. I knew that Liddy was not selling anything. I knew Mitchell well enough. That's why I was there, because Magruder was still trying to figure out what he was working for. This happened in the Attorney General's office. And when I realized that Mitchell wasn't buying any of this, I rest easy. And I did come back and tell Haldeman what I'd seen. There's a second meeting where he comes back in with a pared-down plan. I get to that late and hear the same thing and poured cold water all over it and said, listen, this is craziness. You can't talk about these things in the office of the Attorney General. Fortunately, all that stuff is on tape, too. So I'm corroborated in my recollections of how that all came down.
If you had to come up with someone, would it be John Mitchell? Or
mean,
would it be
who ordered the break-in?
Or no. Would it be that G. Gordon Liddy, being given kind of hazy orders, winds up taking it upon himself?
There's little doubt in my mind how it did happen. Here's what happens. Liddy's plans are approved by Mitchell in Florida at a third meeting, and part of the plans call for an entry into the Watergate. This is something he has discussed with Magruder. Magruder thinks it's fine, thinks it's a good idea, thinks they should try to take some photographs, get anything they can on Larry O'Brien, fish around for his finances and see what they can find out that can be embarrassing. And so he has that general assignment. He does it. And it's a total flop. They don't even get into O'Brien's office. You know, Liddy sort of portrays himself as this James Bond type character when he really is, the record shows, isn't even in the Maxwell Smart capabilities.
He did have a radio talk show for many years. So I don't know what that says about talk show hosts.
That they should stay out of break-ins, I think. But anyway, how's he get in there? What happens is, as a result of the material he's getting out of the DNC, that's coming back to Magruder. Magruder sharing it with Mitchell. Mitchell thinks it's junk, and he picks up the phone. And this Jeb has said this to me at the time when I'm trying to figure out what had happened. He has now said it. He said it under oath. He's been very consistent on this. He said, I didn't know there was going to be a break-in at the DNC the second time. Had no idea. I knew they were getting junk out of there. I was delighted when I saw John Mitchell pick up the phone and ream out Gordon Liddy, who I thought was a jerk. And Liddy took it upon himself to go back in the night they were to go into McGovern's headquarters and fix the bug and figure out where Larry O'Brien's office was. And I don't think Liddy understood until long after he wrote his own book that they had never gotten to Larry O'Brien's office.
Nixon's taping system led to his resignation, but it also gave the public a rare glimpse into the psyche of an executive. It isn't always pretty, but in that sense, wasn't it a gift?
Well, the tapes are, as Bob Woodward once said, and Bob Woodward, who I spoke with, who interviewed me for C-SPAN on this 2 days ago, he is stunned with the new material I found. You know, about 600 tapes that nobody had ever listened to before, and then having better equipment to hear what I was able to hear, it really creates a different story. It fills it in, and there's more logic to the way it happens.
So now he's going to do a revised edition of All the President's Men.
He doesn't have to because, you know, his story really isn't in the Oval Office.
My guest is John W. Dean. His latest book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. It is published by Viking, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with John W. Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal. His latest book is called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. It's published by Viking. And looking at many of these conversations, nearly everyone in the Nixon White House comes across as almost pathological. Was this specific to the people in Nixon's orbit, or does power on that level make everyone a little crazy?
I'm not sure the answer to that. I don't think, you know, I didn't see them that way at that time. I didn't see them behind closed doors, as this book lets you do, because it's based on their these very private recordings that nobody knows are being made.
Nixon knew they were being made.
You know,
do you think he ever was working to the tape, or did he forget?
There are instances where it's clear that Nixon knows he's recording and is doing it very consciously and making a record. The person who seems most conscious is the only other person who knew about it was Bob Haldeman. In fact, when it really gets to the crunch in the later part of this story that I reveal, Haldeman won't talk to the president about some, obviously, were some very sensitive things he wanted to discuss. He says, let's go to the Lincoln sitting room where there's only a telephone recording. And, you know, he's conscious of it. Ehrlichman doesn't know about it. Kissinger doesn't know about it. I suspect it late. In fact, that suspicion results in it being revealed. But no one really knows. So these are about as candid as you can get. And Nixon, because it's voice activated, he's not turning it on. He forgets. He forgets all the time.
And we get a real insight into his psyche on these tapes. In one from July 1972, he describes a dream to H.R. Haldeman and says, "I have a feeling Watergate's going to be a nasty issue, but I can't believe, maybe I'm whistling in the dark, but I can't believe that they can tie it to me." Was he in denial?
Very prescient is what he was. He had some sort of vision of where this could go. Very interesting. They're walking out of the office when this happens, and there's a little exchange, and he's obviously concerned. He just kind of pauses and said, "You know, I had this vision, this dream," and Haldeman says, "Sort of, you know, don't worry, I don't think that's going to happen." Kind of approach.
The cartoon Nixon is paranoid, sweaty, insecure, uncomfortable in his own skin. Was that at all like the Nixon you knew?
No. In fact, one of the interesting things the tapes reveal is that Nixon is a different person with different members of his staff and different people who come in and visit. No question that Chuck Colson brought the darkest side of him out. Haldeman was close. But on the other side, when I'm queuing these up, to listen to the parts of the conversations I want to hear. There were, for example, conversations with his daughters. Most of the personal stuff is withdrawn, but occasionally, because it is government business related, it really didn't fit the criteria of being personal, so these were left in. And these are lovely conversations. He has a nice daughter-father relationship with both girls. Same with his wife. For example, in January 73, when he thinks he's got finally got a peace accord for the battle with the Vietnam War, one of the first persons he wants to talk to is his wife, Pat, and they have a really nice conversation. I'm sure his family was just stunned to hear this personality that is so prevalent on so many of these conversations.
Well, what comes across is that no matter what he achieved, Nixon always felt kind of inferior or vulnerable on some level.
For sure. The more he succeeds, the more revengeful he gets. This is when he's going to turn on his enemies. When things are going well, that's when he calls people in and say, "Now we're going to get them." And he has his list. I would go from the apple of his eye to his most bitter enemy. Another ironic thing about...
Because you want to testify.
I told him I was going to break rank, and that caused serious concern. I was very open. This wasn't something I just sort of snuck off and did. I revealed to them what I was going to do because I really thought the cover-up had to end. And I felt by breaking rank and going to the prosecutors that Haldeman and Ehrlichman would follow me. I thought they would do the right thing. That was one of the great disappointments to me, that men who I had some respect for and thought really would protect the presidency. In fact, Ehrlichman talks about it. You know, maybe we should think in terms of what this office is rather than any personal concerns we have. But he dismisses that when the short strokes are being taken.
Well, it must have been obvious at a certain point that this could lead to impeachment and even worse.
Well, I did. I mean, I think I'm the first one who actually mentions it to Nixon. But Ehrlichman is very conscious of this. At one point, he tells him, I've analyzed this and I realize you can't be prosecuted for any of this. As president, it looks to me, and this is pretty much law now, maybe lure more than law, because the Department of Justice has never confronted the issue square on, but there are a number of very sophisticated memos that came up and got reduced to writing during the Agnew matter, where Agnew was claiming he was immune from prosecution. Well, that's not true, but they conceded the president was probably and should be immune from prosecution.
So Gerry Ford did not have to pardon him?
Oh, no. That was purely his option to and decision. But
would it have mattered if he hadn't? Nixon have been tried?
Oh, absolutely, when he left the office, no longer with the mantle of the presidency.
So he might have gone to prison, actually.
And he has some sort of really kind of sick jokes about it, about how Gandhi went to prison and did some beautiful writing, and maybe he will write in prison.
One of your books is Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. Do you still think that's true after listening to
these
tapes?
Understand the basis of that. That was based on two things. One was the secrecy was far worse with the Bush administration, principally through Dick Cheney's efforts, than it was in the Nixon administration. And the other thing is, I don't think in Richard Nixon's darkest moment he would have used torture as a technique. And I think that's pretty serious stuff.
You note that he believed that he'd been bugged during previous campaigns and that if he could make the fact that it had been done to him an issue, it would put the Watergate break in context. Was that his way of rationalizing dirty tricks? Well, somebody did it to me, so I can do it to them?
You've got two things there. The answer is yes to both, but let me separate them. His thinking that he had been bugged in 68, he raises it periodically, and he thinks this is his great ace that he can pull out and tell the Democrats, listen, you raise this Watergate investigation, I'm just going to raise the fact that I was told by J. Edgar Hoover that Lyndon Johnson bugged me, and it was much more serious than what happened with this bungled burglary at the DNC. Well, that was just not realistic. It wasn't going to influence anything. In fact, it turns out it wasn't even true. They traced telephone calls from the vice president's plane when he was landed in New Mexico, but no bugs were actually placed on him during the campaign. Now, the second part of your question is did he think because other presidents, in essence, had done something that he could do it? Absolutely. He refers to this all the time. He thinks what everybody from FDR to JFK to LBJ, because they had done it, he should do it. Now, the difference, though, is very, very stark. It was an exception to the rule with prior presidents, where it becomes standard procedure with Nixon, and he thinks it's a procedure he can employ, and that's a big difference.
And later, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld talked about the imperial presidency as something that they actually promoted while they were working for Nixon.
Absolutely. They tried to revive the imperial presidency, and Obama is accused of running an imperial presidency. He is not even close to the league.
But he's a Democrat.
Yeah. I told my editor the other day, since I've been here in New York, I said, somebody should send this book to all those Republicans in Congress who are talking about impeaching Obama. This would tell them what the real problems are when you want to think about impeachment.
Well, some people are saying now, anytime you don't like something a president does, you say the word impeachment. It didn't work very well with Bill Clinton.
It's kind of a modified parliamentary vote of no confidence, if you will, because typically they know the Senate is not going to convict and remove, but they're cheapening a very important procedure by what they're doing.
John W. Dean's latest book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. It's published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is the title a bit misleading because The Nixon Defense sounds like you're defending Richard Nixon?
Well, actually, the original title was In Defense of Nixon. And because of that reaction some people had at Viking, I changed it to The Nixon Defense. And the reason what this is, it's an explanation that from day one, from the time of the arrest, Richard Nixon is defending himself, and he has multiple defenses. They evolve, and they get more convoluted, and they get more bogus. He hangs himself on his own defense, and that's why I adopt that title. The subtitle's obvious. That was Howard Baker's question. Regarding the tapes of what, or the tapes do answer the question of what he knew.
And many people believe that one of the most egregious things that was done in his defense was the 18 and a half minute erasure, that gap. You conjecture as to what was on the tape.
Well, I do, because I put a special appendix, because this is, as I see it, largely a media issue, and understandably so. And it became a media issue because Nixon said and pretended like he was cooperating, that he was going to turn over tapes, that he was going to do it voluntarily. And then suddenly tapes start missing. And it culminates with he gives a big speech down in Florida saying, no more problems, come clean, and the next day he has to go to court and say, I have an 18 and a half minute gap in one of these key conversations that have been subpoenaed by the prosecutor. June 20th, first day he's back after the Watergate break-ins. And to me, there's just who did it? While I give you in a note, because that's where I think it belongs, who could have done it, who had it at the had access to this tape at the right time. I don't know. It's pretty much down to two people in my mind. I'm not going to name them.
Well, most people thought it was his secretary.
But I also, in the appendix, explain Rose could not have done it the way she explains, because we found an expert on these machines who had this. Had he not resigned and this been fully litigated, there's an expert that a foreign machine that was brought in, it will not do it. You cannot do it the way she said, with a foot pedal and pressing the button. The machine is designed not to erase in those circumstances.
Since there is so much incriminating evidence on these tapes, why do you think that 18 and a half minutes had to be erased? You would think that would want to erase. I would have wanted to erase everything.
No, here's exactly why he wanted to erase that 18 and a half minutes. And it just that particular tape was subpoenaed. That's the first part. And that whole week, the first week after the break-in, they start talking about covering up what had happened. He has, by the time the gap occurs, he has put his last defense out, which is he knew nothing of a cover-up until after I came in on June 21st and told him there was a cancer on his presidency. So this, if that tape had been produced, in fact, 3 days later, the smoking gun tape is produced, they show he knew, was very involved in a cover-up. So it just blows his defense is what happens.
One of the things that I was unaware of until I read this book was that in September 1972, Nixon tried to infiltrate Senator Ted Kennedy's world by offering him Secret Service protection as a way of getting information about Kennedy fed back to the White House. Did he just want to get some dirt on Kennedy?
Yes.
Did Kennedy turn it down because he suspected?
I don't know. I think Teddy Kennedy was obviously very smart in just saying thank you, but no thank you. And that ended it. In fact, there's an interesting conversation that's in the book about how Haldeman says, well, I'm not quite sure how we do this, how we ask the Secret Service to do this. And Nixon said, well, maybe one of them will just volunteer it to us.
Now, he won the election despite Watergate, at least the fact that we knew that there was a break-in, by a huge landslide. And even though he won overwhelmingly over George McGovern, you say he was in a terrible mood, depressed, and barely able to even pretend he was a winner.
Exactly. And he Actually, I was interested to see how he handled that in his memoir, because it was conspicuous to all of us that this man was just in a funk. Here he was at the highest moment of his life and not happy about it. He speculates it's because the shadow of Watergate was hanging over, that he had this terrible problem.
So he felt 4 years that he was going to be under that shadow.
Yes, indeed.
Well, he was also consulting with Henry Kissinger, who right now is giving advice on Iraq and other things. You write that Kissinger enjoyed bolstering Nixon's darkest thoughts. Did he give him good advice on how to handle the crisis?
I write that because one can read for himself that these are pretty dark thoughts that Henry is sharing and encouraging him to have.
And what kinds of thoughts? Was he suggesting that Nixon get revenge?
Exactly, exactly. And in fact, one of the ones is just of many that popped in my mind.
I gave him a hard interview once. Is he going to get back at me?
I doubt it. But Henry, for example, said to Nixon, he said, you have been so good to the press. They've been so terrible to you. And your biggest fault is you've been too kind to them and not beating them up enough. So that was the typical kind of Kissinger flattery, but was really, as I say, egging him on to even worse.
You testified at the trial of John Mitchell and Maurice Stans that you destroyed two notebooks taken from E. Howard Hunt's safe. What was in them, and why did you shred them?
What happened is there were called Hermes notebooks, and they had lists of names of people that had been involved in the Ellsberg break-in. There were really very little material in them, and it was just a very... As I explain it today, I understand exactly what happened. Is I was in something you call the lost frame. I was in a no-win situation. Here were these. They had been left by mistake. We thought we turned everything over to the FBI. And there was just no easy way to explain why somebody had withheld these, and they just had been misfiled in a safe. So I just said, hell, we'll just toss them in the shredder.
At a certain point in the tapes, you hear Haldeman saying to Nixon, really, your only real route is to destroy Dean.
Well, that
Nixon also calls you a number of names on the tape. The only FCC-friendly ones are bastard and son of a bitch.
I was going to say, it disintegrates from those, too.
What did they do to discredit you?
Well, they put out a lot of false rumors. Claimed I was lying when I was telling the truth. They did just about anything and everything you can think of using the power of the presidency to try to destroy me as a witness. But fortunately, the truth prevailed. And I, I don't know how it would have turned out without the tapes. But I was very comfortable. While I didn't think I could verbatim repeat my conversations, I certainly remembered the gist of them. My biggest fault, and they nailed me for this a couple times, was the fact that I conflated situations and got some dates wrong. But that's about it.
Have you ever speculated about how Watergate would have played out if it had happened in today's media environment?
Well, that's a good question. There was no Fox News at that point, and Fox probably would have been the big defender, although they have not really been aggressive in defending Nixon. It's hard to find a media outlet that really thinks that Nixon did something right in Watergate. So I'm not sure how it would have played out.
We will be talking more about the Nixon tapes tomorrow, because Luke Nichter will be here to talk about his book, which covers quite a different area.
Different area, and they did. He did that book with Doug Brinkley, who is a friend of mine. And I'm sure they've done a good job. And there's no question that the books complement each other. He doesn't deal with Watergate, and he provides transcripts rather than narrative and dialogue, which I have done.
John W. Dean's book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.